In the 19th century, our intellectuals and scientists particularly were discussing the question of mind and matter. What is mind? What is matter? A young man went up to a scientist and said, "Sir, please tell me, what is mind?" And this professor said, "It does not matter." The young man said to the professor, "Sir, what is matter?" And the professor said, "Never mind." Mind and matter were subjects of great controversy. But that is not so the case today. Today, thanks to the advancement of science, mind and matter are no longer regarded as two dual opposite aspects. Mind is affecting the matter. Matter is affecting the mind. There is a close relationship. And therefore, many of the problems at the level of the matter can be solved, not merely by dealing with matter, but also understanding the impact of the mind on matter. Mind has tremendous impact. And with that impact, much of the physical part of our life, the material part of our life, can be changed and changed for the better. This is more and more becoming recognized, because mind and matter, although two different, are closely interrelated. Why should we meditate? I raise this first question. Why should we meditate? We must meditate because there are any number of problems in our life to which we have no solution whatsoever. There was a great novelist in modern times who said that while man can fly like birds in the air, he can swim like fishes in the air, he does not know how to live decently on earth. We can fly, we have faster and faster aeroplanes. We can swim, but our life on earth is very, very miserable. Not able to live together. We are unable to get on with each other. I'm not talking at the international level, but at the individual level, we are unable to get on with each other. Man who can go to the moon is unable to settle his small psychological problems. He cannot settle the psychological problems. He can operate many, many computers and do mathematical problems. But when it comes to the psychological problem, he has absolutely no way whatsoever, because he has never dealt with that question at all. There is a book called The Journey Within, written by an engineer but turned philosopher. And he discusses one instance that took place. A lady telephoned to a doctor, a psychotherapist, saying, "Doctor, I want to see you. Please give me an appointment." And the doctor gave an appointment. "Come on such and such a day." And the lady went. And when the lady went there, the doctor said, "Why have you come? Why have you come to a psychotherapist? We know that you and your husband are happily wed. There has been never a quarrel between you. You have never spoken with raised voices with each other. Why have you come?" And the lady said, "Doctor, you are right. We have never spoken with raised voices with each other. There has been no quarrel amongst us." But the lady said, "Doctor, I have come here to ask you one question. And my question is, am I living with a husband or am I living with a computer? Am I living with a husband or am I living with a computer? Our life is becoming more and more like a computer. The quality of the heart, the quality of love, the quality of affection, the quality that we call the emotional quality seems to be disappearing. So that we are, in this mechanistic age, becoming more and more like machines. And that is why that mechanistic approach does not enable us to find solutions to the deep psychological problems of life. If I am aware of it, and I should be aware of it, because all over the world there is suffering, there is sorrow, there are suicides, there are frustrations, there are psychosomatic illnesses. Man is frantically in search of health, goes to this healing device and that healing device. Why? If I have noticed it, if I have not noticed within myself, If I have noticed it in the outer world that this is what is happening, then surely we can say that we are not living in a normal world. We are living in a world which is absolutely abnormal. If I know it for myself, then I will not have to put this question, why meditate? I will want to discover, to explore that field of meditation. Because all the other fields I have explored, the fields explored by intellect and by various other things, but that exploration has not given me a solution to the problem. I am not happy. I am not at peace. I am all the time seeking escape from myself. If I realize this, then I do not think it is necessary for one to discuss this question, why meditate at all? What is meditation? That is the second question. What is meditation? Meditation is the exploration of the consciousness of man. This consciousness is a secret. This consciousness we do not know. We have mastered the science of matter, but we are ignorant with regard to the science of consciousness. And yet modern physics is more and more talking about consciousness as the very foundation of the physical universe. But what is this consciousness? How does it function? This whole subject of the exploration of consciousness is the subject matter of meditation. Meditation is the exploration into the inner space about which Julian Huxley speaks. Inner space. What is there in that inner space? Is there anything or is it a void? What is there in inner space? The exploration of the inner space, because it is that exploration which will make meaningful my exploration of the outer space. Otherwise, the exploration of the outer space will have no value whatsoever. In fact, we will go in for more and more destruction so long as the inner space has not been explored. And meditation is the process by which the inner space can be explored. I do not want to enlarge upon these two questions, because the other two questions are more important, I am sure, so far as the subject of meditation is concerned. When to meditate? It's a very strange question. When to meditate? Does meditation require any preparation? Yes, it does require any preparation. And what is that preparation that is required? Meditation is the exploration into inner space. This exploration requires tremendous energy. And unless and until I know the secret of creating more energy, I will not be able to go into the exploration of the inner space. It demands energy. From where does energy come? Ordinarily we know the electrical energy comes when the two poles meet. When the negative and the positive pole meet, then the energy is created. This is exactly the same thing so far as energy in consciousness is concerned. The positive and the negative poles must meet. The masculine and the feminine aspect of consciousness must meet. Today, people are talking of yang and yin. The scientific writers are talking of yang and yin. If you go to Capra's book, The Tao of Physics, he has a chapter on yang and yin. Yang and yin are the masculine and feminine classification in Chinese philosophy. In Indian philosophy, this classification is Shiva and Shakti. Shiva and Shakti are the two classifications so far as this phenomenon of the masculine and feminine aspects is concerned. Unless and until these two meet, there is a book by Lawrence Hyde, an Englishman, a very remarkable thinker. The title of his book is Isis and Osiris. And in that book, this Lawrence Hyde says that today we are living in a masculine civilization. Here, masculine has nothing to do with the biological aspect. Whether man or woman, we are today living in a masculine civilization. Masculine civilization is an aggressive civilization. Argumentative, logical, mathematical, wanting to prove. Not only prove that I am right, but I want to prove that you are wrong. This is the masculine civilization in terms of consciousness. And the whole world today is governed by masculine consciousness. There is no wonder that we are lost in the forest of these arguments, these aggressiveness, this logic and mathematics. I'm not saying that logic has no value. I'm not suggesting that we must become illogical. But if it is only logic, if it is only mathematics, if it is only argumentativeness, then we can't come together, we can't live together. Because it is all a masculine civilization dominated by the masculine consciousness. There is no touch of the feminine consciousness. We need the touch of the feminine consciousness. Once again, not biological. We need those qualities of feminine consciousness which must function side by side with the masculine consciousness. Today the psychologists tell us and medical people tell us that the brain, which is divided into two hemispheres, there is the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And today all our activities are devoted to the development of the left hemisphere. All our education in schools, colleges, universities, they are bent upon strengthening the left hemisphere. But the poor right hemisphere is absolutely dormant, or well-nigh dormant. It does not come into the picture. And the psychologists tell us, the medical people tell us, that the left hemisphere is a masculine hemisphere. It is the right hemisphere which has compassion, which has love, which has affection, which has consideration, which has those soft qualities which are not to be found in the masculine part of the consciousness. There is a time, the time has come, when we talk of the holistic approach. Leave apart the higher holistic approach. There must be, first of all, the holistic approach so far as the brain is concerned. So that not the fragmented brain, but the brain that is whole, where the two halves are functioning together, where the masculine and the feminine aspects are functioning together, where Shiva and Shakti are functioning together. It is this which is of fundamental importance, and it is this which meditation enables us to do. Meditation has both the positive as well as the negative poles. And because in meditation the positive and the negative meet, there is the generation of energy. We need this energy, and that is why meditation has become very, very important. When to meditate? We can meditate only when there has taken place certain withdrawal. Withdrawal. I don't say renunciation. I don't say running away. I am not talking of the philosophy of escapism. But there must be a few moments during the day when we withdraw. When we withdraw from active involvement. Just go within ourselves. Even if we can't go up to the center, at least there is the withdrawal process. This withdrawal process is very, very necessary. Arnold Toynbee, who was one of the greatest historians of our time, he has written 6 volumes of human history. If you turn to the 6th volume, the last volume, Arnold Toynbee says that whenever there are critical periods in history, he says, I have seen a particular phenomenon invariably coming up. And it is this phenomenon, he says, which has saved humanity from being run over by the crisis. What is this phenomenon? He says this is the phenomenon of withdrawal and return. That there are few people at least who withdraw. Who withdraw, try to find out the center of their existence. Try to find out what are their values. What are the values that they have determined? What are the values that they are pursuing? This process of withdrawal must be there. And then of course return. Go to the daily activities. But there must be time to withdraw. I'm not talking just now of meditation, but just ordinary withdrawal, because that ordinary withdrawal will enable us to regain the rhythm which is lost, the rhythm between the center and the circumference. But you will say, how does meditation help us to create energy? Meditation has 4 aspects. First aspect of meditation is visualization. I don't like the word visualization. I prefer the Sanskrit and the Buddhistic words. But visualization has found its way today, particularly in medical books and scientific books. Visualization. Even cancer, which is the despair of the medical man today, even cancer being approached through the process of visualization, you will find here in your country the Simonton Institute of Cancer, where they are experimenting through visualization to deal with the problems of cancer. Visualization. But as I said, I don't like the word visualization, because visualization means we are using only the visual sense. Well, the fact of the matter is that all the five senses, because let us confine ourselves to five senses. The scientists tell us we have 20 senses. We don't know where the other 15 senses are. But the five senses are good enough or bad enough. These five senses must be involved in this process of visualization. That is why in Sanskrit language, it is known as Kriya Shakti. In Buddhism, it is known as Vajrayana. Kriya Shakti. Kriya Shakti has two aspects. There is the formative power of thought. Thought has a tremendous formative power. There is the formative power of thought, and there is the directive power of consciousness. Kriya Shakti and Ichha Shakti. If you turn to the book of Madame Blavatsky, who was the founder of the Theosophical Society, she has written a fascinating book, The Secret Doctrine. In The Secret Doctrine, she deals with this subject of Kriya Shakti and Ichha Shakti, the formative power of thought. We have not used this formative power of thought. Thought has tremendous power. By thought forms, we can create many, many things. In fact, there is no doubt that as you think, so you are, because it is thought that builds up the pattern. It is the thought that builds up form after form. And this formative power of thought has tremendous possibilities, which we have not used. In meditation, this needs to be used, the formative power. But the formative power must be associated with the directive power. Remember, these two powers in the Indian tradition are associated with Tantra and Yoga. Yoga and Tantra. Yoga is the philosophy. Yoga is that which enables you to find the direction. Yoga is that which enables you to discover the values of life. But how to implement that? How to bring that into daily practice? This is the work of what is known as Tantra. And therefore, Yoga and Tantra, the formative power of thought and the directive power of consciousness, these two must simultaneously function. Then we will find that it is possible for us to do great many things. Supposing you want to get up early tomorrow, not that you must get up, there is no particular virtue in getting up early, but supposing you want to get up early, say 6 o'clock, don't say, oh, 6 o'clock is much too early. If you want to get up at 6 o'clock, what do we ordinarily do? We go to bed with a firm determination, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. You look at the watch, oh, it's 2 o'clock, let me go to sleep. Again 3 o'clock, let me go to sleep. Oh, 5 o'clock, I have still one more hour, and I go to sleep and get up at 8 o'clock. This is what happens. Why? Because we have not used the instrument of the formative power of thought. Try it. Before you go to sleep, see yourself, visualize yourself. Not that you will get up, but you have already got up. You are moving about at 6 o'clock. Other people are asleep. But you are breathing the fresh air of the morning. You see yourself. And if you see yourself, make that image as clear, as intense as possible. Forget it. Give that program to the brain, and you will find that your brain wakes you up after 3 or 4 days. Don't expect it to happen tomorrow, but after 3 or 4 days, you will find that the brain automatically wakes you up. Why? Because the brain is a computer. And to that computer, you have given a program. And this computer knows only one program, and that is the program of images. It does not know the program of language, not the words, but the images. If your visualization is clear and intense, then you can bring about changes in the pattern of your life, whatever may be the pattern. You can change it without any struggle whatsoever, because you have programmed your brain computer well and left that program with the brain, not meddle with it. Then the brain processes that program and produces the result far more quickly and far more magnificently than any computer with which we are accustomed. There is another thing. When do we have more energy? We have more energy when we are in a pleasant mood. When we are in a happy mood, we have more energy. When we are happy, we invite people to tea. Come on, come for tea. But when I'm morose, I'm sad, I'm depressed, please don't come. Don't come near me. When I'm happy, I have more energy. Now, it is possible through visualization to create conditions of happiness. I'm not in happy conditions. But through visualization, you can create conditions of happiness. You can see yourself in a happy frame of mind. You can move about as a happy frame of mind. You can see yourself moving with friends and inviting friends. Just see it, visualize it. And if you do it, that itself will generate more energy. The brain will have more energy because of this happy situation about which you have visualized. This visualization itself is a science. I will not go further. But this visualization can be utilized for meditation. For what? First of all, for concentration. We are unable to concentrate. One disciple went to a master in India and said, "Master, I want to meditate. On what subject shall I meditate?" And the master said, "Meditate on any subject you like, but don't meditate on the monkey." And the disciple was very happy. "The master has given me so much freedom. Leave out the monkey." He sat in meditation 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, got up. And the master asked him, "What did you meditate on?" He said, "Sir, what am I to say? You gave me so much of freedom. You said, leave out the monkey, but I could not leave out the monkey." The monkey was all the time present. Not only present, but the more I tried to remove the monkey, the more the monkey said, "If you persist in this, then I shall bring my whole family before you." This is our concentration. We are unable to concentrate. Because in our concentration, we are all the time resisting. Oh, this is undesirable thought. It must not come. And so all our time, whether half an hour, 1 hour, 2 hours, whatever it may be, we are not meditating. We are struggling with something that is undesirable. And the more we resist, the more is the persistence on the part of that undesirable thought. And therefore, concentration is not resistance. Then is concentration absorption? No. Some years ago, when I was moving in our compound of the Theosophical Society in Banaras, we have a large compound, there was a boy of about 4 or 5 years old. That boy was pulling out grass and collecting grass. I was interested, so I asked this boy, "What are you doing?" He gave no answer. I asked him second time, "Please tell me, what are you doing?" No answer. Third time I asked, "Please tell me, what are you doing?" He looked up at me and said, "Don't you see what I'm doing? Why are you asking this question? Don't you see what I'm doing?" I said, "Yes, you are collecting grass, but why are you collecting grass?" He said, "In order to feed my horse." But I said, "I don't find your horse anywhere." Then he pointed to a wooden horse. The poor thing was not even able to stand. And this boy was collecting grass in order to feed that horse. But he was completely there. Could not be disturbed. Nobody could distract him. In fact, he resented any distraction. He was totally there, completely absorbed there. And yet I would say concentration is not absorption. Because for absorption you require a toy. So long as the boy had a toy, the boy was absorbed. If you take away the toy, then the boy would be beside itself. Similarly, you and I, the elder people, also require toys. It may be the toy in the form of a mantra. It may be image. It may be a sentence. It may be room. It may be something. So long as I have these toys, I can concentrate. It is no concentration at all. In fact, one of the beautiful definitions of meditation and concentration that is given in one of the Hindu books is drashyam vina sthira drashti manascha alambanam vina. This verse says that I have nothing to see and yet my perception is absolutely clear, stable, steady. I have nothing to see. If I have to see something, I can understand because I'm interested in something and therefore the perception is steady. But nothing to see and yet the perception is steady. And then it says that the mind requires no support whatsoever. The mind that does not require any support, any crutch, the mind that is completely free and capable of looking after itself, it is this which is the condition of concentration. Remember, concentration is neither resistance nor absorption. But then what is concentration? Professor Ernest Wood, he was a very eminent author in the theosophical circles. In one of his books, he defines what concentration is. He says, concentration is attention without tension. Concentration is attention without tension, no tension whatsoever. But we have tremendous tension. Oh, I want to concentrate. I must close the doors. Please don't come. Don't disturb me because I'm going to concentrate. All the time, tense, tense and tense and tense. And that is why we are not able to concentrate. Why? Because our concentration appears to be an exclusive awareness. I must only look at this and nothing else. But that is not how the eye perceives. If you go into this question, you will find that our ordinary perception by the eye has two areas. There is the focal area and there is the marginal area. The eye doesn't say only focal. I may see at a focal point here the people who are sitting in front of me. But when I do it, my eye is aware of the people who are sitting in the margin. The focal and the marginal areas, they function together. This is not something amazing. When you drive a motor car, what do? When you drive a motor car, your attention is at the center, in front. But you are still aware of what is going on the road, in the margins. If you say, no, I must not see anything in the margin, then you won't be able to drive your motor car, you will break down. You will be full of tension. But because you are able to see, you are aware, not as clearly as you are aware of things in front. Because you are aware of what is going on in the margin, because the focal and the marginal areas are together, you are able to be completely relaxed. You may drive for miles and miles and yet you are relaxed because you are not engaging yourself in exclusive awareness, but you are engaging yourself in extensive awareness. Extensive awareness is the secret so far as concentration is concerned. We saw what is the element of withdrawal through visualization. Next step that we come is concentration, because visualization helps us to concentrate. Because the object that is kept in abstraction, we can't hold our mind. We can hold our mind if there is something that I can see, something that is visualized. Here we come to concentration. And concentration is the preliminary step to the experience of meditation. Concentration, as I said, is extensive awareness. You decide, I want to concentrate on a particular idea. Visualize it. And you tell your mind, you are free to move in the margin. Don't go very far, but you are free to move in the margin. If you allow the mind to move in its own margin, then the mind will say, all right, this is a gentleman's agreement. You go on in the focal area, I will go on in the marginal area. Try it. You will find, like the driving of a motor car, that it is possible for you to keep your attention at the focal point because you have allowed the mind to move in the marginal area. If you do it, do you know what will happen? Immediately, you and your mind will be on friendly terms. Today, we and our minds are not on friendly terms. And therefore we are all the time suppressing what the mind wants to say. And out of that suppression we have created the enormous problem of the subconscious. We are all the time suppressing. And therefore by saying to the mind, you move about, I am giving you freedom to move about. You give me freedom to move here. We are at gentleman's agreement, and you will find that the mind is able to maintain this gentleman's agreement. It has confidence in you. You are not going to suppress the mind. And therefore a climate of confidence is created between ourselves, the conscious mind and the subconscious. Between the conscious and the subconscious, a friendly relationship has come into existence. It is from there. That is why I said when to meditate. When you have done visualization, when you have done this extensive awareness of concentration, then you will be able to come to the experience of what meditation is. How to meditate. We come to how to meditate. How to meditate, as I said, is the primary interest so far as we are concerned. These days very many people say, oh, observe the mind, observe the mind, observe the mind. Observe your thought. Try it. The moment you want to observe, the mind closes its shop and says, I have nothing to reveal. You will not be able to observe anything. You will find there is nothing to observe. Why? Because there is no confidence. The subconscious mind has no confidence in you, and so it has closed the shop. It says, I'm not going to reveal to you. And therefore, just saying, observe the thought is meaningless. You can observe the thought only when the climate of confidence has been created between the conscious and the subconscious. And therefore, if you want to ask me how to define concentration, I will say concentration is the awareness of distraction. Just awareness of distraction. What is it that is distracting me? Don't resist it. Because the moment you resist distraction, it will become a disturbance. And therefore, to be aware of distraction is concentration. If you have done that, then you come to meditation. What is meditation? Meditation is a dialogue with distractions. Dialogue with distraction. Establish a dialogue with the subconscious. Because it is the subconscious that is troubling us. We have suppressed it. It has no freedom, it has no confidence. Now through extensive awareness, a confidence has been created. And therefore the conscious mind can start a dialogue with the subconscious. And the subconscious will speak now, because it has confidence. It will reveal. When the subconscious reveals itself, just see what it reveals. Listen to what it has to say. It has a long story. It's an untold story, because nobody has listened to that story. Now you will be able to listen to it, because a climate of confidence has been created. Meditation is a dialogue with the subconscious. The conscious and the subconscious dialoguing. If the subconscious becomes little reticent, persuade it to speak. Give a chocolate, give a lollipop, give something, so that the subconscious is induced to talk. Induce the subconscious to talk. This is what the psychotherapist does. If you go to a real good psychotherapist, the psychotherapist will say, if we can make our patient talk, 75% to 80% of our work is done. This is exactly the case. If you can make your subconscious to talk, it will not talk so long as there is no extensive awareness. But it will begin to talk. And when it talks, just listen to what the subconscious has to say. And you will find that as you have listened, as the subconscious has told its story, it has nothing further to say so far as that particular subject is concerned. It has become quiet. It has become silent. You have not silenced it. It has become quiet. Because you have listened to his story. And you have listened to the story when it is willing to tell the story. And therefore, in the telling of the story, it becomes completely quiet, completely silent. This experience of the silence of the subconscious is the preliminary experience of meditation. I will not go further. This is the preliminary experience of meditation. Come to it. You will find it has tremendous vitality. This silence of the mind has tremendous energy, tremendous vitality. Even though that silence may last only for a few seconds, even those few seconds will be greatly vitalizing. But you cannot silence the subconscious. The subconscious must come to a silence when a dialogue, a meaningful dialogue has been started. When this happens, then you experience the miracle of meditation. What is the miracle of meditation? Edwin Arnold in his Light of Asia speaks about nirvana, about the ultimate spiritual realization. And he says it is the dewdrop slipping into the shining sea. Is that all? This seems to be completely negative. So far the mind has come to a negation by a totality of silence. Silence is negation, and it has moved through the process of negation. But is it all? Is it there that the entire meditational process ends? No. It is there in that total negation of the mind where the dialogue with the subconscious started and the subconscious has become quiet, silent, in a state of negation. There comes the positive experience. There comes the experience of realization, experience of illumination, experience of an intuitive flash, call it by whatever name you like. It comes there. And it is this, the meeting of the positive and the negative. It is that which generates energy. We can have the generation of energy from day to day. If we have understood the secret of meditation, of a dialogue with the subconscious, listening to it, the subconscious becoming silent, in that negative atmosphere of silence, there comes the positive experience. What is the nature of this positive experience? The nature of the positive experience is that it is true that the dewdrop has slipped into the shining sea. But the great miracle has happened. The entire sea has entered the dewdrop. The entire sea has entered the dewdrop. The tiny individual consciousness has become universalized. The whole universe, as it were, has entered the individual consciousness. Because of the space created, because of the total negation of silence, of complete silence, in that complete silence, complete negation, this positive experience of the expansion of consciousness, not merely an extension of consciousness, but expansion of consciousness takes place. The dewdrop slips into the shining sea. But at that moment, the great miracle happens. The entire sea enters the dewdrop. This is meditation. Why? What is meditation? How to meditate? What meditation brings about, when to meditate, how to meditate, and what is the result of this meditation. Every day, day after day, as you come to this experience of the positive and the negative meeting, you will come out of meditation with great ecstasy, with great joy. No problems of tensions. You have known the secret because you have found the source of energy, inexhaustible source of energy. And you can put yourself in touch with that inexhaustible energy. And therefore, where is illness? Where are frustrations? Where are tensions? Where are stresses and strains? They have disappeared in that very moment of the subconscious becoming silent. And therefore, into that silent, the pouring in of the positive experience. Patanjali says towards the end of his book, Patanjali has written Yoga Aphorisms, the textbook on yoga. He says there is a spiritual experience comes. But when does it come? He says when you do not enter this field of meditation with a moneylender's mentality. No motivation whatsoever. All motivations have ceased. There is a total negation, the total silence. When that total silence is achieved, then he says there takes place the bursting of the cloud of benediction. The grace comes, prasada comes, benediction comes. In the light and in the strength of that benediction, all the problems have been resolved. I can go to that fountainhead of inspiration whenever I like, because I have understood the secret so far as meditation is concerned. I suggest this is necessary. We have only touched upon this subject very briefly, but this is necessary. If you and I are to be healthy people, sane people, intelligent people, looking at life's problems in an intelligent manner, then we must find out this path of meditation, because it is along this path of meditation that we shall find the great miracle happening, that the entire sea enters the tiny dewdrop. The tiny individual consciousness has become vast. It has become universal consciousness. It has become cosmic consciousness. This is meditation, very, very necessary, imperative today, if we are to find our roots, our centers, and establish the rhythm between the center and the circumference. This is the way, the only way where you don't have to depend upon anybody. You can stand on your own feet. You don't require any guru to help you. You can do this whenever you like. In your homes, you can do it. And this will show to you the great miracle, the great ecstasy, the great joy that meditation is able to impart to us in the midst of the daily struggles of human existence. Thank you very much.